Now this morning it is ethics, of course. Can you keep a secret, the duty of confidentiality? Our presenter is Richard Antill, one of our list members. Richard was admitted in 2003 and came to the bar straight away. He has a commercial practice. Professional negligence is one of his areas of expertise, which will become obvious why in a moment. Also property, particularly personal property securities, insolvency, and commercial matters in general, as well as equity and trust. In the 11 years Richard's been at the bar, he in fact took 2 or 3 years leave of absence, where he worked as a risk manager at the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee, and hence the expertise that Richard brings to us this morning in the topic of ethics and confidentiality. Through the time that Richard worked with the Legal Service and the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee, he worked with solicitors, assisting them in managing the risks of practice. He was involved in delivering an education program. He was working on a daily basis, hand in hand with practitioners on ethical issues, and hence he brings that expertise to us this morning. So please welcome Richard Antill.
Thanks, Michael. One of the luxuries that I had at the LPLC, I had many luxuries. I had access to all the claims and notification files and the database and all that sort of stuff. But the other luxury I had was a bit of time to contemplate and discuss and research the whole idea of CLE, what's effective, what's not. And it seems, unfortunately, that sort of one of the most ineffective ways of delivering CLE is exactly this sort of thing, a passive learning exercise where you sit in the audience and I just talk for an hour. And it's a real problem and I don't have a solution for it, and it's one of those things that we just continually come back to these sort of sessions. In researching that and discussing it and so forth, I came across this one video which I found incredibly profound, and I often use it in my presentations, really just as an opener. It's I suppose called Releasing the Fraudness. It was a conference that was held by an organisation called CLEAR, the Continuing Legal Education Association of Australia. It's made up of a lot of the PLT providers and learning and development people within the firms. They had a conference in 2010 and they had a forum, and the speaker is Steve Marks, the New South Wales Legal Services Commissioner. And this is what he had to say.
One of the things that I've discovered, this is just a inspirational aid. What seems to actually resonate with lawyers today is when you run into, if you're trapped in a passive learning exercise, which most of our CLE is, and if you're a provider that has to deliver it, it's boring as batshit, and it's really a hard role to play. So one of the things that I've found that kind of works a little bit is to try to actually somehow tap into the fact that all lawyers are frauds. We train them to be frauds. We give them an educational system which tells them that they know what they're doing. Then we put them in a practical situation where they're presented a problem with problems that have all kinds of issues that have nothing to do with law, psychology, all kinds of other issues. And they're supposed to know what the answers are. And because of that training process, what we actually never do is kind of release that fraudness in them. Let them say, you know, you guys are okay. And so one of the things I've found is that by talking about the role lawyers play in society, the fact that they're promoters of the rule of law, the fact that it's the third pillar of a pluralist democratic society, the fact that they actually do good things, starts to work with them. So actually dealing with basic psychology of fraudness and trying to actually encourage lawyers to actually see that they do a really good job and play an important role in society opens it up to a different type of learning.
So it's just a snippet. I found it very profound when I first heard it. I still think it's profound whenever I see it. I mean, I think particularly giving a lawyer a lecture on ethics is very difficult because there's a certain inherent fraudness that you can get trapped into where you say, these are our ethical obligations, you know, this is what you have to do, and everyone nods and says, yes, we know that because we're ethical lawyers. But it's sort of, you know, there's ethics, there's the rules, but then there's the real world. And the real world is really messy. You know, when you come across an ethical dilemma in the real world, it's messy often, and there can be differences of opinions. There can be, you know, as many different opinions as there are people in the room in terms of real life ethical problems. So there's a real discrepancy there between the black letter position of saying these are the ethical rules, this is what we all must do, and reality. I'll just flick over to my slides, because I can't get away from PowerPoint. It's terrible, and we shouldn't use it, but I still do. So in terms of what are the objectives of this seminar, I think really I'm going to aim low and say, as long as you walk out of this room and say that wasn't quite as boring as batshit, then I've done really well. particularly when you're talking about ethics lectures. There is sort of really, in terms of the content of my seminar, really there's just sort of a grab bag of ideas where I think ethical, the obligation of confidentiality arises in practice, where I've seen it arise in practice. But really, you know, look, you're getting your ethics point. If you can pick up something from the seminar, that'd be great. If you want to ask a question, please do. You know, if we can make this into a discussion forum, that would be fantastic. It often doesn't happen, but sometimes it does. So if it goes that way, I'd be more than happy for it to go that way. Okay, let's go through some of the fundamental things. Sources of a duty of confidentiality. There's the professional conduct rules that I'll flick through. There's contract, equity, common law, sources. There's express and implied undertakings, and in particular the implied undertaking in home office and harm that I want to mention, because it is an important thing to be aware of for all litigators. There's the Privacy Act and other acts. You know, there's a multitude of acts that have confidentiality obligations. In terms of the LPLC, there's a specific provision in the Legal Profession Act that says that all employees of the LPLC must keep that information confidential, so I can't discuss individual claims. And it's not just the legal profession that's subject to confidentiality. Doctors, accountants, psychologists, you know, we're not in a special position owing duties of confidentiality. Just as an aside, I remember hearing and being amused by a story that a psychologist told me, how she was working in a small country town, and a stranger, or just someone from the street, walked into the clinic holding a document that was in fact notes of a private session with a client, and saying, look, I just thought you'd like to know, this was on my front lawn this morning. They did an investigation, you know, a whole sort of as to why this had occurred, and they discovered that their secure document services amounted to the local tradie picking up the bin in his, you know, the open top bin in his ute and driving through town on a windy day. So, look, you know, these things happen, and it's not really just the legal profession, that's where it happens. So, professional conduct rules. It's right up there in front in terms of 1.1. You must act honestly, fairly in the client's best interests and maintain client's confidences. It then goes in rule 3, there's more of a detail in terms of confidentiality, and there's a few sort of instances where you can disclose. You can go through that in your own time. We might flip back to it if there are any questions. And then there's the Australian Solicitors Conduct Rules, which I don't think have come into Victoria yet. Maybe if I'm wrong, you can correct me. These are the conduct rules that the Australian Law Council have promulgated. If you've got time, you might want to compare the two and see where it's a bit different. These ones go into a bit more detail about some of the exceptions. I don't propose to go through those in detail. One of the interesting things, particularly when I started preparing this presentation, is to sort of say, well, what are the consequences of a breach of the duty of confidentiality? Have there been pecuniary loss claims made? Have there been disciplinary? Has a solicitor been disciplined for a breach? And actually, whilst I was at the LPLC, I went on a specific search for an example of a claim that had been made against the solicitor for damages or for pecuniary loss arising out of the breach of confidentiality, and spent a fair bit of time searching and didn't come up with anything. I just couldn't find any sort of claim or notification really that fitted the bill. Similarly, with disciplinary consequences, I've sort of done searches and haven't really come up with any examples in reported cases where a practitioner has been disciplined for specifically for the breach of the duty of confidentiality. And I suppose in that situation, you say, well, why is that? Well, why aren't there more claims? Is it because, I didn't search hard enough? I think I did search hard enough. Is it because lawyers are just vigilant about this and they never, ever breach their duty of confidentiality? I'd like to think so, but I'm cynical, and my experience in practice is it's probably not the case. What are the other possible explanations? Well, clients probably maybe don't find out if there's been a breach of confidentiality. If they do find out they haven't suffered loss, or they can't prove they've suffered loss, or they can't prove that there's been a breach, or probably more likely in that sort of scenario, the last thing they want is further publicity by bringing a claim against the solicitor. So, there's all sorts of possible explanations. I suppose in terms of consequences, probably the greatest consequence would be reputational damage. Our reputation is everything as practitioners, both individually and as firms. If a client became aware that you as a firm had breached your duty of confidentiality, then that's obviously going to have a detrimental impact on that relationship. So that's probably the greatest impact from a pragmatic point of view, but an important impact. Where does it arise? So there aren't really specific examples, as I say, of pecuniary loss claims or disciplinary claims. So what I was forced to go back to is think about where does it actually arise in practice? And certainly one of the big areas where it does arise is in applications made by former clients to stop their old solicitors from acting against their opponents in litigation. And there are a multitude of these cases. One of the leading cases is Spin Code. If you put Spin Code into Austley, you'll find heaps, and you can read through those examples. And in those cases, some of the cases succeed. The court will order the practitioner to cease acting for that new client. And one wonders then, I suppose one is left with the thing, well, is that as far as it goes? Is there any disciplinary consequences as a result of that? And I think most commonly there wouldn't be. But it's where it arises. And it arises because you have this duty of confidentiality to your client that exists even after the retainer is finished. And if you're acting for a new client, you're under an obligation to the new client to use all of the information at your disposal. So there's this conflict between your duty to your former client, duty of confidentiality, and duty to the existing client. And if you have a look at the cases, as I've put in there at the bottom of the slides, there's the Spin Code case. And there's also, I think, an interesting sort of dicta that's often referred to in these sort of applications, I think of Justice Gillard, where he says, the overall opinion formed by a lawyer of his client as a result of his contact may, under circumstances, amount to confidential information that should not be disclosed or used against the client. The getting to know you factors. So that in itself, your knowledge of the client, whether they're risk averse or they're gung-ho about litigation, that itself can be confidential information. And it's often in those sort of cases, I don't know if anyone's done those sort of applications, it's difficult for someone bringing that sort of application. They're in a sort of a dilemma because the last thing they want to do is go along to court and say, my former solicitor has confidential information about me, which is, he knows my accounting system is absolutely shot. Any information I produce from my accounting system is completely unreliable. And so that's why I want him to stop acting for this person I'm suing. It's not the sort of thing you really want to be doing, is identifying the actual confidential information that you're concerned about. So in these applications, there's often you have to go along and say, here's the getting to know you factors. It's all the vibe, if you like. So that's one area. Another area which is very important to be aware of, and it's something I certainly didn't learn at university and I only really picked up in practice, and I think a lot of practitioners aren't aware of it, and should be, particularly in litigation, is the implied undertaking in Harman, the Home Office and Harman case. And this is that if you or your clients obtain documents as a result of compulsion in litigation, so as a result of a discovery process or orders for affidavits or interrogatories or something like that, if you get documents under that process, then there is an implied undertaking to keep those, or so to not use those documents for an ulterior purpose. And it's an undertaking that's owed to the court, and it's punishable as a contempt of court. So it's something to be aware of in practice. There was a recent High Court decision in Hearn and Street, which gives you a bit of flavour of what can happen. It was a dispute about Luna Park up in Sydney. I don't know if you're aware, but up in Sydney they reopened Luna Park. It made lots of noise because they had the roller coaster going up and down and people screaming. And in the time that it had been closed down, they built, you know, the developers had built lots of units around. And so the residents there were horrified that all this noise had started up, and so they brought proceedings to try and close Luna Park down. In part of those proceedings, they exchanged, I think they filed and served affidavits and part of an acoustic report, gave it to the other side, gave it to Luna Park, and then the officers of Luna Park used that information, they gave it to the press, and they gave it to the Daily Telegraph, and there was an article written. And they also gave it to the Minister for Sport to encourage the Minister for Sport to pass special legislation to protect them from these ridiculous claims of noise nuisance, which worked. It was a great strategy. They got the legislation through, but then the residents found out about it and brought these contempt proceedings. And the High Court indeed found that the directors of Luna Park, or the officers of Luna Park, were in contempt because they'd breached their implied undertaking. Home Office and Harman. So it's occurred in terms of my personal practice. It's arisen in my practice. The story I've got is we brought proceedings against a trustee of a trust who, and when we went to judgment, the judge said that the trustee had breached virtually every duty she could have. And in the course of that, we obtained documents through, obviously, discovery and subpoenas. Most of those documents went into the court book and were tendered into evidence, and that's one of the things. Once the documents are in the evidence, the open court, you're released from that undertaking. But not all of them were. There were some that didn't go into the court book. And then as a result of that judgment, we wanted to pursue a claim against an accountant who really assisted the trustee in these breaches in accordance with our obligations to try and resolve it. Prior to litigation, we entered into negotiations. We were allowed to give the whole court book to the other side and say these are all the documents because they'd been tendered in evidence, but there were some other documents that we just couldn't. We were bound by this undertaking. Now, we could have gone back to court and asked for the release of the undertaking, but the whole purpose was to try and resolve it without going to court. So really, all we were left with was this situation where we said, we've got these documents, we can't tell you what they are, we can't tell you what they say, because we've got this implied undertaking. But we're very confident we can prove a particular aspect of our case. I think it was actually quite a good strategy, because when that settled, we got a fairly generous offer, which I'll talk about in later in my talk as well, because it raised a separate issue. So that's my personal experience of Home Office and Harman. Another thing to be aware of is the duty of recipients of confidential information, because this is where you can really get caught out. There was the case of GT Corp and Amir Safety back in 2007. Who knows about this case? Yeah? A couple? Okay. It's worth knowing about, because it's something you've got to be really aware of when you receive documents from another side in litigation. What happened was it was a case where there was large amounts of discovery in the electronic format. Some of the documents that were discovered were privileged. The recipient of those privileged documents, reading between the lines of the judgment, and I hope I'm not stepping out of line here, but I think the recipients went, aha, we've got some really interesting documents here. Obviously they're privileged. Let's send them up to our barristers to see what our barristers might say about them. And the barristers then looked at them, and they went, ah, oh, this is really interesting. So they sent sort of cute letters back to the other side saying, you know, we assume you've waived privilege over these documents. You know? And then the other side, the party that had disclosed the documents discovered it, they brought on an application to get those documents back. Not only to get those documents back, but to restrain the solicitors and the barristers from continuing to act. The solicitors and barristers who'd received the information. And they were successful against the barristers. The barristers were kicked out of the case. So, which is, you know, not so good for the barristers, not so good for the client. In fact, and it's just a situation where they've just received inadvertently, it wasn't their fault, they received this inadvertently privileged material.
Were the solicitors in there as well?
No, the solicitors survived.
They gave them to the barrister?
I think the solicitors, reading between the lines, I think the solicitors have been a little bit more careful. And it was sort of saying, as I think the solicitor, the specific solicitor, wasn't going to be in the firm, wasn't going to be acting in the case anymore, so they could sort of, it's an interesting case to read. It's certainly an interesting case to be aware of if you're involved in litigation. What was referred to in the judgment were these inadvertent disclosure guidelines that have been promulgated by the LIV that no doubt you're all aware of. If you're not, there are. I've included a copy in the material handed out, so you should have a look at that. Because if you do receive that sort of information, your obligations are really to stop reading as soon as you realise that it's privileged, and it's fairly onerous obligations to go back and check, to talk to your client about the clients, get instructions from the client about the client wants to do. So it's I think a really important thing to be aware of. And then following on from there, more recently, just as another anecdote, there was a High Court decision, Expense Reduction Analysis Group, and Armstrong Strong Management, Norton Rose, same sort of thing, huge amount of discovery, electronic discovery, you know, the sort of thing where you've got, you know, teams of solicitors and barristers reviewing documents on an electronic document management system. Somehow, some privileged documents slipped through. They provided the other side. Application was brought to have them returned. It was up in New South Wales. Trial judge said no privilege is waived. Court of Appeal said no privilege is waived. High Court said no privilege is not waived. And you, the recipients of the information, have to pay the costs. So that was a bit of a... Again, you've got to be careful about these sort of things. You've got duties as a recipient, not to do fairly important duties of a recipient of confidential information. Is the duty reciprocal? Has anyone ever considered this? Do clients owe a duty of confidentiality to solicitors? Or do patients owe a duty of confidentiality to doctors? Is it simply an esoteric question? Does it have any practical significance? Well, I think it does, and this brings up my second anecdote, and it might be just a curious way to put this in because I think it's an interesting fact. The case I was talking about before against the accountant, we got the offer. It was in the form of a Calder Bank letter, clearly a Calder Bank letter. They were going to rely on costs if we didn't accept it. It was simply, we'll pay your client a large sum of money, and there'll be a deed of release drawn up. We accepted it, and not surprisingly, the solicitors then drew up a terms of settlement which included a confidentiality clause and a non-disparagement clause. And we saw instructions and we said, no, we're not going to agree to that. And there was sort of, it was an interesting sort of negotiation because the solicitors on the other side were baffled and they were saying, but we always include these terms. You know, this is run-of-the-mill. Why wouldn't you agree to it? And we said, well, it's not in your offer. You've probably been in the same situation. It's actually a pet hate of mine when I'm a barrister and I'm conveying offers. I try as hard as I can to say, is that everything in your offer? Before I actually go and get instructions, is there anything else that you want to put in the offer? Because one of the things I hate when you're particularly in a mediation, you get to the stage where, okay, we've agreed, and then suddenly other people go, but we want a confidentiality clause, or we want non-disparagement, or we want that sort of thing. It just bugs me. But in doing, because it arose, I then did look into it, and there are a couple of instances where a call-to-bank offer, or I don't know if it's a call-to-bank offer or an offer of compromise, has been knocked out because it included a confidentiality term, and at the end result, that obviously it went to judgment, and there isn't any confidentiality, so the offeror hasn't done better than what his offer is. So that's something to be aware of when you're crafting offers. If you're really doing it for strategic reasons, you've got to think about whether you want to put in a confidentiality clause or not. On the flip side, if you don't put a confidentiality clause in, again, there are cases and dicta that I've put in the handout, you can't just say, we always do that. If it's not a term of an offer, then you can't just sort of add it in later. I mean, it's simple principles of contract, but there are some dicta there if you need confirmation of that. So it's, if you're acting for a defendant, you've sort of really got to grapple with those two scenarios. I mean, you can always, as someone said, you can always make the offer with the confidentiality term. If it's not accepted, then make the same offer without a confidentiality term on the basis that it's probably not going to be accepted. But obviously, if you're acting for a defendant, you want to get instructions about that, because the last thing you want to do is go back to your defendant and say, yes, we're stuck with this settlement and there isn't any confidentiality.
You get situations where a professional advisor of some sort makes a recommendation that might put a disclaimer on the advice saying this is only intended for you, the client, not to be disclosed to any other person. How does that work in that sort of scenario? Does that impose a duty on the recipient then not to start passing advice around all their friends and so forth?
I suppose if you're providing it, it's a term of retainer that you can, I suppose if I was a barrister and it was a term of my retainer, I wanted to make it clear that the advice that I was giving, the memo of advice, which should not be circulated, then I could make it a term of my retainer that it'd be confidential. If I wanted to impose it later, you could try, but you'd need to get an agreement. But again, if it happens, what are you going to do about it? It's one of those things. That's
answering the question. But you just see the sort of statement on various recommendations and advice that float around.
Yeah.
Getting accountants and people like that.
That raises the whole issue of sort of negligence in that sort of advice and to what extent you can rely upon disclaimers, particularly for auditors, and there are high court cases about that, about the high water mark on a, if you're familiar with the Pittwater property up in Sydney and where the high water mark was and whether the real estate agent could rely on a disclaimer, that sort of thing. It's an interesting area. But it's another source of confidentiality obligations, it's contractual obligations, or simply representations that might make. Inducing witness to breach their confidentiality obligations. If you're interviewing a witness, you've got to be aware that you don't really encourage, you have an obligation not to encourage witnesses to breach their confidentiality obligations. And so a high-profile example here, high-profile litigator now, federal court judge, Google search and find his name. He engaged in the tort of inducing a breach of contract by asking questions of an ex-employee, where it was clear that it was by the ex-employee answering those questions, the ex-employee was breaching his confidentiality obligations to his ex-employer. So, again, that's where confidentiality can arise in practice. Yeah?
Were those questions in private conference or in the course of formal examination in court?
I think private conference. I think they were preparing, you know, they were sort of really just, talking to this witness to try and get a witness statement from him.
So if it had actually been in open court, is there a risk that by asking them in the case when they're under oath, you'd use so much breach confidence there?
I think you could probably assume that their confidentiality obligations are overridden by their obligations to answer questions in court, so I don't think you should be too concerned in that scenario. But more so in private, when you're really briefing, or you're interviewing witnesses for evidence. Okay, let's have a break there.